Good morning, diners and travelers, and in the case of this particular program, imbibers,
yeah,
especially
drinkers.
Yeah, and especially if you're tending to favor the southern hemisphere for this kind of thing.
All kinds of southern hemisphere stuff today, and all kinds of things that go into cocktails, and lots of information that you didn't have before, probably, about three spirits which are common to Latin America, as Anne was describing. I guess tequila is not really south of the equator, but never mind.
Well, that's true.
Never
You're
mind.
The geography,
for the geographically challenge, we'll call it Latin America. You remember Dan Quayle saying that he was sorry that he slept through Latin class because it would have enabled him to speak to all the people from
Latin America.
You remember that one? They good old Quayle, man. They thought he was really smart. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to business. What do we have?
He's actually back in the news.
Yeah, starting out the program, we have extraordinarily fine tequila from Mexico, and a very good explanation of why that tequila is so good.
He was good.
Yeah, he was really good. And a beverage that originates in Bolivia. You'll find out some more about it. One time it was certainly extraordinarily illegal. Now it's legal and interesting and a great cocktail mixer. So in the first segment then, we've got Reyesal tequila and Agua de Bolivia.
Well, I've always loved tequila, and I was surprised that it was being revived because I never knew it went away. Inaki Orozco, you have this wonderful company. Tell us about it.
Well, thank you. The name of the company is Reyesal Imports, and we own a family line of tequila products of the highest quality, made in Arandas, Jalisco, which is the heart of the highlands, which is noted for great soil components, having a lot of minerals, plus the altitude, being it's the highlands, that is beneficial for the agave plant, which is a raw material for tequila, to segregate all the sugars to in turn make a very good and tasty and great textured tequila.
Now, you mentioned to us before we came on the air that a lot of people think agave must be a cactus because they associate Mexico with cactuses, but it's really not. It's a different kind of plant altogether.
You're absolutely right. It's a typical misconception, you know, about the agave plant because it looks like a cactus, and it typically grows in desert-like areas. But actually, agave, and the blue agave, per se, that is the only type of agave that can be used for the production of tequila, is a lily. And it is a lily because it's a succulent plant. And as you know, lilies, most of them live on the water. And agave sucks all the water from the rainy season, and then it auto-feeds itself the water through the desert droughts.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, another thing that I had asked you about, because I didn't know, your agave is cultivated. Is almost all of the agave that goes into tequila cultivated?
It is. And once you harvest it, it definitely goes into tequila. Now they are finding and they're using it for other things. I mean, the sugar of agave is one of the only pure sweetener. So not like honey and sugar that have to be refined, but agave nectar comes in its pure form. And it delves very well with a digestive tract because it has a lot of antioxidants. So there's other things that people have been finding great use for agave.
Now, we also found another use for agave nectar, but we'll come back to that in just a second. Because, again, interestingly enough, in the history that I read before in preparing for this interview, apparently the Spanish invaders of Mexico were the people who really perfected the art of making tequila, but before that, the Aztecs made something quite similar.
That's correct. The Aztecs, what they did was only a fermentation of the pulp in a maguey plant, which is not related to agave.
Oh, I see. So it's a different plant altogether.
It is a different plant altogether, and what came out of that is called pulque.
I know pulque.
Okay,
yeah.
So pulque is made from mezcal, and mezcal is different than agave.
Absolutely.
Okay, very
good. But you're absolutely right by stating that then the Spanish, with their more modern practices, they introduced the distillation process. And that is when the tequila or the mezcal got perfected, and then it became tequila.
Okay, so they started working with the agave, and they fermented that too, I guess, as well, and then they distilled a spirit from it.
Exactly, and the reason was that the king of Spain was upset because it was very costly to import brandy from Spain. And so the Spanish, obviously, they were avid of drinking, and they found this local stuff, but to their dislike, and that's how they perfected the fermentation of maguey, and it turned into first mezcal, and then tequila.
It's really interesting. It's sort of the reverse of a phenomenon that we heard about in a recent program talking about pisco in Peru, because apparently the king of Spain at the time, who helped found the pisco industry, stopped the import of Peruvian wine from Peru into Spain. So as a result, they had to figure out something to do with the grape juice, and they made pisco out of it. So it's sort of the opposite arrangement. Maybe if the Peruvians and the Mexicans had gotten together, they could have just traded directly.
Right.
But they probably didn't even know each other.
No, I don't think so.
Inaki, what are the... you sent us three different kinds. Are they different grades of tequila?
And the difference that lies between the three classifications is aging. So we typically, in the family of tequilas, we have... Now there was a newest added category, but typically you're going to find a silver or a blanco, which is unaged. You're going to find the reposado, which means rested, and it is rested in oak barrels typically. Origin, it could either be France or typically the United States. Barrels are used for bourbon, and the reposado, you age it anywhere from 3 months up to 11 months and 29 or 30 days. And as soon as it hits the 12-month mark, it's denominated añejo. And as
old.
I was saying, what's that?
That's aged.
That means aged, exactly.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, there was a new introduced category called an extrañejo, which is anything above 3 years and beyond. It's now classified an extra aged.
Wow. So now, what are the qualities of a premier tequila? I mean, I would say, first of all, from your what you make, it's smoothness.
It's definitely smoothness. It's definitely the texture, you know, the body, and it's definitely the tasting profile. And the origin of that, as I was explaining before, comes from the soil. The soil is a key piece in having a well-balanced tequila. Just like in wine, where you have the terroir,
yes.
In tequila, the soil is crucial.
So you've got terroir in tequila too.
Exactly, absolutely. You got terroir in the way, as I said, the highlands of Jalisco. There was a lot of volcanic erosion, which left a lot of minerals laying on the soil, and specifically to the Rio Azul land, it was a virgin land before I did anything, and so these minerals feed in a very natural and direct way into the agave. And these minerals are the most important agent of nutrition for the agave. So that's really where the secret starts, you know, and having an agave with a high quality of bricks, just like in wine, which for who doesn't know, a brick is just the ratio of sugar to water contained inside the grape or the agave plant.
Okay, so what you're actually working with is this product that you call agave nectar. The agave nectar is when it hasn't been distilled. Well, I guess it hasn't been fermented and distilled, but that's where you start from.
That's exactly right. I mean, once the plant is mature, after an average of 7 years, and this is why the soil is so important, because it's sitting on it for 7 years, so the quality of the soil is crucial. Then we go to the transformation process to make it tequila. The first process, since the fibers, we cannot extract the sap or the liquid, the sugars, as you said, as it is, you have to cook it. So you cook it to make it meshable. Once it's cooked, you can extract the fibers that you then ferment, which is another extremely key part of the process because of the yeast that you utilize to ferment, which all it really does, it turns the starches, the sugar, into a low grade of alcohol.
Right.
From there, you do a distillation, which again, it's very important because of the types of material that you use to distill. which are going to release flavor profiles that are going to infuse your tequila. After that, it's very simple. You either bottle it for a blanco or you age it in the time frame that I just referred to, for a reposado, for an añejo, or for an extra añejo.
And I think it would be fair to say, Inaki, that you shouldn't look down your nose at blanco, the unaged tequila, because it's a fine product in its own right. So it's not like thinking of it as something that's not finished.
Absolutely.
It is, in fact, finished and ready to go when it's in the bottle. Now, one of the reasons that we connected with you, although we missed the official day, was there was an official day of tequila back in July, and for that you developed a special cocktail. You want to tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely, and I apologize we missed each other on the tequila day, but we developed a couple of cocktails. We did an American flag cocktail for July 4th, for the American Independence Day. There's a tradition in Mexico, you know, that tributes to the Mexican flag. And as you know, the culture of tequila drinking in Mexico is sipping.
Yes,
really,
yes.
Really sampling and sipping. And so we created, typically in Mexico, you emulate the flag by initially drinking a little sip of lime juice, which is the green part of the flag, then the tequila, which is the white part of the flag, and then you chase that with a little sip of sangrita, which I'm sure that you guys are...
Yes, what is that? I love that.
It's a spicy sauce, but it doesn't have any tomato in it. Paul thinks it has orange juice in it. I used to have it in Mexico. It's really good
the
stuff.
Sangrita in Mexico, let me tell you guys that I was just there, and I had a hard time coming back because it's very hard to find a good sangrita here in the U.S. I'm on that venture now, but...
you're going to make that, huh?
Yeah, there's many, many different recipes. So the base, yes, is tomato juice sometimes, but people are now switching it up for clam juice because it has a little more flavors already embedded in it. And yes, some people add orange juice, and there's, depending on, you know, the spiciness level, you add Tabasco or whatever adding ingredient that you want to give it the spice that you desire.
Now the bartender at the
American, I was just going to say that
the bartender at the American Airlines Club in Mexico City's airport, he used to make his own sangrita starting out every morning.
And those are the best ones, I'm telling you.
Oh, I love that stuff.
Well, let's close out with Nectar of the Gods, because it brings together three things we talked about: the agave nectar, the pulque, and the tequila.
So the actual drink that we created was the American flag, and all we did was substituted the sangrita for a margarita made out of cachaza, which blue cachaza, which is a Brazilian, you know, a Brazilian liquor.
Right.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And we found it to be a perfect chaser for the, I mean, it was very small liquor content, obviously, but it was a very nice chaser for the tequila, and that's how we spun it to make it an American flag versus a Mexican flag.
I see.
But now the Nectar of the Gods is a combination of the things that I mentioned just a little bit ago. So it's agave nectar and equal parts of pulque and tequila, and that sounds like pretty much fun too.
Yeah, the Oakley. I was a little reluctant here, but you know what? I was pleasantly surprised, and I really give a lot of props to our master distiller because our tequila is so versatile. And it's so versatile that it mixed pretty well with the pulque. And I was surprised at the outcome of this Oakley beverage that we created with pulque as a base.
Now let's do this. As we close out, let's give a website, perhaps, where people can find out where they can get your tequila?
Absolutely. Our website is riazul.com. That is riazul.com. And I invite everybody to visit the website. I mean, we have not only where it's found, but we have a lot of recipes. It's very interactive. It's very easy to navigate. And we're always open for posting suggestions, too.
Well, we thank you very much for providing information that's taken away some of the mystery of tequila and pulque. We now understand it a whole lot better. Listeners, you do too. Thank you so much, Inaki, for joining us on the program today.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime.
Thanks, Inaki. Bye-bye.
Bye, Anne. Thank you.
We certainly do love new experiences, and Chuck Giametti You provided one for us in the form of agua de, no, how do you pronounce it, agua de Bolivia?
Agua de Bolivia, right.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about this. A liqueur?
Yep, it's a liqueur, and we use the word agua, A-G-W-A, no Q's, because that is the South American spelling for water of life, and this is a product that is made out of coca, and coca comes from South America. To put it bluntly, it starts on a runway in La Paz, Bolivia, where a 2,000-pound bale of coca leaves is waiting at the airport to be loaded into an airliner, then under armed guard, taken up to Amsterdam, met by armored cars, and taken to a laboratory where the 0.08% of one of the alkaloids is removed, so it could be non-addictive and so forth. You know, they take off that stuff.
Yeah, but you still have the effects like cocaine?
No, nothing to like cocaine, but you will get an upper buzz. You get a good feeling to it. It's a drink that'll tune you in.
Drink some of this.
Yeah, you know when you drink and you feel perfect and then you screw it up because you drink too much?
Yeah.
Well, that's because you're skewed and you can't want it to feel even better. Well, it's 60 proof alcohol.
Uh-huh.
With coca leaf and guarana and yerba mate and Chinese green tea and ginseng and alcohol, a formula that was formulated in Europe during the 1800s, okay, and refined by taking out a lot of sugar and adding 21 more grams of coca in agua. It's a drink that was designed to keep you at the click. Now, what do I call the click? You know the movie Cat, I've seen the play. In the movie, Burl Ives looks at Paul Newman and says, you know, what are you going to do with your life? And Brick comes back, he says, it ain't happening, Big Daddy. He says, what ain't happening? Click that goes off in my brain that puts me in that peaceful place when I drink alcohol. Well, I like to keep you at the click, okay? Yeah.
Now, this the movie you're referring to is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe Tennessee Williams tried some agua, too.
Well, he sure is a great person to have on board. Because, you know, when the rest of the world was drinking absinthe, or they thought that when our world today thinks that they were drinking absinthe back in the 1800s throughout France and Europe and so forth, they were really drinking coca wine.
Is that right?
Yeah, and coca wine made its way to the United States into the East Coast and was then formulated to be a soda fountain drink with the removal of alcohol and the addition of syrups and so forth, effervescent water, and it was served at a soda fountain and then sold off as a recipe for $300, and it became a soft drink.
Called Coca-Cola.
Possibly, yeah.
Boy, you sure know a lot of stuff here.
You do.
I'm full of useless knowledge, you know.
just as a reminder, listeners, this is the same plant as cocaine?
It's the same plant that they would make anything having to do with any of the cane products like that. Yes, it's coca leaf.
It's an opiate.
All of our coca leaf comes from above the 4,000-foot mark in the mountains where they're growing, and they're decocainized. That means they take out any addictive properties, any kind of anything that would be bad for you.
And you must have a whole bunch of kind of funny employees.
Well, really not. You know, it's a pioneering company that made its way to the U.S. The brand is healthy in the growth plates of the world right now because of it's emerging. It's a new category. It hasn't been around for 150 years.
Yeah, how long have you been doing this?
Since about the year 2002. I got involved with it in 2000, and we brought a product to market that wasn't the same. It wasn't as good as the product is now. In about 2002, we sold that for a few years. And then we had all gone, met in Amsterdam, and decided that there was too much sugar in the product and not enough coca. And we reformulated it and repackaged it into a beautiful new package. And I say, too, you know, the word coca is right on the bottle. And coca as an ingredient. And this is one of the only products that I know of in the United States that has the word coca.
Well, I mean, how do you get approval for this?
That is something that we'd have to talk to Babco International about, because they went on for 9 years getting approval through the FDA as a flavoring and the BATF as a, or the TTB today, as a alcohol product. And what had happened is there was a licensee who has a license to process coca in Amsterdam for all of Europe. And they
Why Amsterdam?
Because that's where the license was.
Uh-huh.
Back in the 1800s. And they went ahead and they reconstituted the license to be, when the Euro Union came in, the license was reactivated. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh, wow.
And
yeah.
Reactivated. And and then they started to process the coca. And any of the bad stuff that comes out of the coca leaf goes into pharmaceuticals.
Now, let's just position this for listeners who are thinking about this not just as a curiosity, but as a beverage itself. You're targeting it as a cocktail mixer.
it's a great cocktail mixer. It's very neutral in taste. If you taste the product and you compare it to a vodka, let's say, a vodka will burn the back of your throat a little bit because it's 80-proof alcohol. Agua is only 60-proof alcohol, and it's a liqueur, which means it's sweetened and has other herbs in it, like botanicals of sorts, right?
Did you say yerba mate is in it?
Yep, yerba mate. You know
so
what yerba
mate
is?
So that's a stimulant. Of course I've had it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
if I were to compare it to something, and it's really an invidious comparison because both Agua and this other product I'm going to name are very different and very excellent in their own right. But color-wise and in a way, in its taste, it's a little bit like green chartreuse.
Yeah, you're getting there. But chartreuse is a pastis in many taste profiles. It's got much more sugar in it and much, much higher proof.
Right, but it's headed sort of in that direction. So if you can think, listeners, of any cocktail that would be enlivened by something like this, the mojito is one that I know you have in the information that you sent us.
Yep.
And then you also said this product goes intriguingly well with a lime, and perhaps you can explain that.
Well, the lime activates the alkaloids in the cocoa.
Okay, so what do you do in order to get that? How do you put it in a glass? Or do you
take the lime, the best way to do it, to feel it for real, is you bite a lime and do a shot, or do a shot and bite a lime.
Okay.
Now there is a bar in northern Wisconsin called Brown Jug, the Little Brown Jug, and they go through oodles of agua up there by putting it on the rocks with a slice of lime in it.
There you go. Now, where can people find this in distribution, Chuck?
It's a little sparse right now because we've just started, and we're a one-brand company and it's hard to get attention with the second-tier distributors. But we're in 32 states.
Now, do you have a website with purchase
points? Go to www.agwabuzz.com.
Agua Buzz.
Yeah. And one other thing you'll see on the website is the owners of the company being foresighted. They bought a building in Amsterdam. It used to be a house of ill repute. And the building came with a sex license, of course, and, you know, how Amsterdam configures into it all.
Sure.
And they wanted to start a museum devoted to the coca leaf. So they bought the building, and they wanted to get a liquor license. Well, there hasn't been a liquor license given out in Amsterdam in the last 40 years.
Really?
So they traded the sex license that came with the building for the liquor license.
There you go. Well, that's pretty smart. So
and in that building are old artifactual products that were made in Europe during the 1800s and things that made their way to the U.S. and manufactured in the U.S. in the United States at the turn of the century, at the 20th century, that were like coca cough syrup, coca cough drops, the old bottles from Europe that were all over. We found all this stuff via eBay and researching, and we were able to acquire enough material where we were able to go ahead and get all this together, okay, and put it in the museum.
I don't know how we missed this museum when we were in Amsterdam.
Maybe it wasn't there yet. We were there like 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, has it been that long?
Yeah, it's been that long.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for a fascinating story, Chuck.
Thanks.
And listeners, get yourself lined up. You want to surprise your friends with something new in the cocktail department?
Got it.
This is the way to do that.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Oh, Chuck, you're having fun. I'm glad to hear it.
All the time.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye now.
Bye. Well, now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're discussing drinks. It seems, Rabbit, that every culture, every civilization has had something mind-altering produced.
I guess you could call it that.
Sure.
And in the case of Pisco from Peru, the story is a very interesting one, and the personality is going to talk to us about it. Herbie's a very interesting character, too.
He is, indeed.
So since we almost went to Peru and almost experienced Pisco there for ourselves, it was wonderful to have the opportunity to sample some here, which we did. And then we talked to the person who provided it to us, and he told us the fascinating story of Pisco in Peru.
The first time I heard the word Pisco, I thought, you know what, this is a fairly unfortunate-sounding name for a drink. But I'm guessing that it means something special in Peruvian, and Herbie Lobo, who's Peruvian, is certainly the man to tell us about.
Yeah, it's originally a word that it actually has multiple meanings. It originated from a city that is the lower part of Peru. It's a valley in the southern part of Peru called Pisco. The word comes from the word Pishku, which is a Quechua word, which is a Peruvian Indian language that was indigenous to the Incas, and that's still spoken today in areas like in Cusco and in the interior of Peru. And that word really came to mean a bunch of different things. It came to mean, for example, Pishku in Quechua was not only the name of the city and the valley, it was also the name of the native birds from that region. It also became the name of ceramic, the ceramic jars that were used to carry pisco in the early days were also named piscos. So when the liquor started being produced and then being transported in these ceramic jars called piscos, that's when it ended up actually becoming that the distilled spirit became the name pisco.
How old is this?
Pisco originated in, I want to say, the late 1600s. I don't have the exact date, but it really came to exist when the Spaniards brought grapes to the Americas for the first time for wine producing. King Philip II in Spain, at one point, from pressure from the local farmers and the local winemakers in Spain, illegalized the importation of wine from the Americas, and that created almost a vacuum in the region where there was all these wine producing areas, and they didn't have a place to sell the wine, and the local indigenous people wanted to have a stronger beverage. They didn't like wine. They didn't like the sweet, low alcoholic wine. So they ended up distilling it out, and that's where Pisco came from. And that was anywhere from 300 to 350 years ago.
Now it's basically fermented grape juice.
Yeah, it's Pisco is basically an unaged brandy. We use grapes that come from a vineyard, specific grapes, different varietals that we have in Peru that we use for Pisco producing. We ferment them out like a wine for about 18 days, and then we take that must, that juice, and put it in a copper pot still and distill it to proof. It's actually the only spirit category in the world that collects body and distills at proof and bottles at that. There's no other that does it this way.
Now, we sampled some just a little bit ago, getting ready for the program.
Okay.
And our take on it was, boy, this tastes an awful lot like grappa, and especially a version of grappa, which is...
Carova.
We know it's made by the Nonino family called uve, and the difference between grappa and uve is made from grape juice, just like pisco.
Yes.
Whereas grappa is made from the skins and the
fresh
stones and everything else you can imagine.
Exactly. That's where the difference between grappa and pisco, when somebody first opens up a bottle of pisco, it does have some of the same aromas. The subtlety and the softness, if you will, of a pisco drink versus a grappa drink, which is a lot more fiery, is the fact that you are using that first press, so you get a lot more of that characteristic and body from the grape juice, where, like you said, the grappas are using the skins and the second press of the grape and everything that's left over after they've pressed it out for making wine.
Now, this is exceptional, though. This is a pisco, which is Gran Sierpe.
Yes.
And that's your family's brand?
Yes. It's actually my father and I own it. We began the project really trying to link a historical fact with a family that we're partners with in Peru that has a very long-standing history in pisco producing, that comes from a small city in the south of Peru called Monte Sierpe. And that's kind of a play on word to mean mountain snake. And when we linked with this family that had a history and owned a distillery 300-400 years ago, you know, we wanted to link it to that original story, and we wanted to have a very high quality premium product that can also have a historical meaning behind it. And the words Gran Sierpe is great snake in Spanish, a play on the word serpiente, which is serpent.
Oh, yeah.
And the secondary meaning of that is that in Inca culture, the mysticism behind symbols that they used to describe different things in the earth, like the condor would be the symbol for the sky, the monkey would be the symbol for the forest, and the serpent would be the symbol for the earth.
So, okay.
Yeah, we felt that that was something that could tie it into the Peruvian culture and also be a very modern, unique take to a product.
Now, you were also trying for a quality of product, too, that was outstanding, I think.
Yeah, we definitely did not want to come out with a pisco that would be regarded as a low-quality Pisco. We went above and beyond to make sure that we get the best quality grapes and the best quality production from our distillery, and think that we've captured a very nice quality Pisco.
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is very rough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like
some of them are definitely not as formal and not as specific in terms of quality control of the grapes that they use, so it could mean that some might not be as good as others, and we feel that ours is a pretty good premium quality Pisco.
Oh, it's nice and smooth. I mean, are you supposed to sip it, or are you supposed to
You can
mix
sip it if you want to taste it on its own to see what the spirit tastes like, but we, being here at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, we're experiencing a renaissance of white spirits in cocktails outside of vodka. White spirits with a character and a body, so that when a cocktail is made the right way and it's balanced, you're getting some of those flavors from the fruits and the juices that are being used in the cocktail, but you're also getting to taste that spirit, like mezcal, tequila, rum, cachaça, pisco. These are all white spirits that have a body and a character, so they lend very well to making a very good drink.
Now, you just had a competition between several top mixologists, didn't you?
Yeah, we just had one actually in Miami that we hosted, and we actually, the winner actually won a trip to come to Tales of the Cocktail, and it was an Iron Chef style competition, so we had 12 bartenders from Miami go head-to-head against each other with secret ingredients given to them right before the round. And the winner actually made a drink using tahini paste.
My goodness.
And it was a very interesting, creamy, almost like an eggnoggy kind of texture. And the drink was exquisite. We actually have it on our Facebook page.
I think that sounds great. I mean, it must be very yeasty flavor, huh? So tell us a little bit about where you are and what you're doing there.
Well, Tales of the Cocktail, obviously, as you know, is the once-a-year annual celebration of cocktail culture and the ability for a lot of bartenders from all over the country to get together and share ideas and innovate together about everything having to do with the bar and the beverage.
We've been there. We've been to the museum.
Yeah, that's, I mean, obviously having the cocktail museum here and having such a rich culture of cocktails in New Orleans, being really the first city that created the cocktail with drinks like the Sazerac and things of that nature that are over 100 years old, this city is the perfect place to have an event like this. And having Pisco have the ability to actually share with bartenders and non-bartenders alike how versatile the spirit is, people are really gravitating to it. They're really enjoying it here.
Well, that's great. Now, why do you think all of this is becoming... I mean, Pisco is becoming extremely popular.
I think there's just a renaissance, like I said before, of consumers and trade wanting to experiment with other products. I think being bombarded with the same type of products all the time gets a little boring. You can only have so many vodkas behind the bar before you want to try something else. So,
we just had bacon vodka.
I met Stefan actually in Las Vegas.
We interviewed him for...
In fact, you might be on the same. There's a good chance you'll be on the same program.
Oh, and shochu is the other one. We have.
That's a good product too.
I haven't had any of that. I'm on a big learning curve here.
I think you're right about how many kinds of vodka can you have. It seems the market seems to be unsaturated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, certainly people are going to be looking for something different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see doing something with Pisco in a reinvented Sazerac, quite honestly.
There's sidecars, too, that people do because of, rather than using brandy, they're using Pisco. But you can really lend, it really lends well to many cocktails, including the most famous Pisco drink is the Pisco Sour.
Right.
Oh,
created by an American living in Peru in the early 1900s. His name's Victor Morris. And created that cocktail because there was no whiskey in Peru. So instead of a whiskey sour, he created the Pisco Sour, and that was almost 100 years ago.
There you go. So it's an amazing thing how these products are reinvented.
Harvey, what did they
rediscovered?
Drink? What did they drink in the Peru before they had Pisco?
The indigenous people drink almost like a moonshine that's made from corn called chicha de jora.
Oh wow!
Which you get in Cusco and you get in the Amazon, it's literally a corn moonshine, and it's a very, very strong alcoholic product. And it's not, I mean, it's not bottled, it's not commercialized. It's just something that people make in their home.
Probably makes you blind too.
It sounds like the stuff they drink in Guatemala. They end up the market. The women wait to have somebody carry their husbands home.
Well, we wish you great luck and great good fortune with your new venture trying to...
Yeah, thank you so much for the time and the attention.
This has been fun.
I would welcome you guys to check out our page, discoverpeaceco.com, for some more information
on the brand itself and
on the history behind it. And also, we would love for your listeners and yourselves also to become friends of ours on Facebook, where you get to see some of the stuff that we're doing to get the word out about Peace Co. So definitely check it out on Facebook. Just, you know, search for Grand Sierra Bay Peace Co. And also discoverpeaceco.com.
Okay, so that's it.
Now, hold on. There's one more application which is so fundamentally simple, and you probably know about it, but you haven't mentioned it, and I would recommend it, and that's to treat it just like you would a grappa, which means you keep it in the freezer.
And you
bring it out after dinner and after you've driven home.
hopefully after you've driven home.
just to complete the evening. And I thought that treatment would be the right thing to do, and that's exactly how we're drinking it now.
Yeah, I think if somebody wants to try the spirit on its own, that would be a definite way that I would go about it.
Great. Well, Herbie, once again, thank you so much for joining us, and back to Tales of the Cocktail for you, I guess, huh?
Thank you so much for the time. You guys have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. Enjoy yourself, bye. Herbie. Bye.
And since we're transitioning from Pisco to vinegar, I guess we ought to take a break in between.
You can actually drink vinegar. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, but it's a little different than Pisco.
Yeah, but are we going to ever go to Peru?
I don't know.
Herbie said that they've rebuilt and they're now running the train to Machu Picchu.
I'm glad we didn't go when we planned to go, because you couldn't get there from here.
Right.
But that's a story for another day.
Okay, so let's take a short commercial break.
No, we're not taking a short commercial break, I don't think. Are we taking a short commercial break? Yeah, I guess we are. I lost my way. I didn't know where we were in the program. Sorry, Miss N's right as usual. Now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and we're going to proceed along now with, I don't know if I've ever told you how much I love vinegar. But I do. I love it. I love to sip it. I don't like raspberry vinegar, but I do love wine vinegar. And this next product, the Rosa Doll vinegar, is a spectacular product.
That you're going to want to know more about.
Oh,
and
yes.
Guess what? You're going to find out.
Expert.
Yeah, you're going to find out some more about it.
Now, some might think that vinegar is a pretty straightforward subject, but in the hands of this current guest, Kurt Ammon, it is not. It's a very complex issue. The product is very deeply complex, and I love it, Kurt.
Well, I think the biggest problem, when you mentioned it now, is to overcome that vinegar has to be cheap.
Yes. I mean, I'm not even talking about price. I'm talking about, how did you get to making vinegar? Let's start there.
All right. Well,
now, you're from South Africa.
Yes. In 1988, we are a farm making wine, and wine means normally red wine. We had a problem with the wine, and the wine turned towards vinegar a little bit. So we just took 2,000 liters and made vinegar from it. So it was an involuntary situation. It was nature that taught me how to make vinegar. Winemaking is avoiding making vinegar. And most vinegar is made from the leftover of things you couldn't make wine from anymore. So this is now vinegar made from excellent wine, the best grapes, the best wine was used to make vinegar. When the vinegar is finished, which takes about 5 years, then we macerate it with herbs. And the herbs are chosen for healing purposes, not for taste.
But it tastes good.
Well, you know, all good things taste good. But unfortunately, lots of bad things also taste good, because man has learned how to disguise bad quality.
Well, now, what is it that makes vinegar so healthy?
It's important that vinegar is raw and it's made in a natural way. Otherwise, it's not healthy. If you take our vinegar and you heat it up above 120 degrees, it will no longer have the healthy healing capacities. a good naturally made vinegar has the capacity to take all excess acids out of your body, meaning it balances your pH. And health starts and ends with pH. Of course, there's also the mineral, the earth. It's the four elements: earth, water, air, and fire.
Now, you follow in your production, or when you're growing your grapes and in the production of vinegar, biodynamic principles.
Yes.
Is there a simple way of describing that?
It's not so easy, but people can go and watch it on YouTube if they punch in Rosendahl vinegar. But basically, it is intentional farming. And quality is really a spiritual energy. The rest is quantity. So it's not something which you can easily measure with it, but it's a vitality, it's a force, it's there.
Now, let's spell it, R-O-Z-E-N-D-A-L. So when people are Googling it, they know to get the correct spelling.
That's correct, yes.
And do you know, Rabbit, I think Kurt would be able to answer your cousin's question about the universe.
No, I don't think so. Let's not go there.
Able to do that.
Let's not go there. It's much too long a story, and the story of Rosendahl vinegar is much more important. And there's one thing that we must get across here that Anne hasn't mentioned yet, and I'm really not sure why she didn't mention it, because it is what drew her attention to your product in the first place. There are literally thousands of entries in the Fancy Food Show in New York every summer, and this year Rosendahl wine vinegars won
the best overall new product out of the thousands of entries submitted.
So there's something pretty special going on here.
Congratulations, Kurt.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You would say it's all in the family because you're not even there anymore, right?
That's correct. It's my daughter who makes the vinegar now.
So let's say hello to her, shall we? What's her name?
Natalie.
Natalie, here's congratulations from On the Menu Radio and its many listeners for winning the Gold Sophie for Best New Product in the year 2010, and keep up the great work.
I will tell her. Thank you very much.
Now, tell us a little bit about your different, I even hesitate to call them flavors, but they are.
Well, they are, yes, but basically they are, the way we make the vinegar, we just, what we find, what we have on the farm, or what is very healthy, like we use green tea, and we make sure the green tea that comes from China is of a very good source. It's a very small family, it's organic, and it's the best. It's the ingredients. Every chef knows that it's the best ingredients make a good meal. Then you don't have to disguise the food too much.
Right, now you have a lavender.
We have a lavender vinegar, which is excellent for more on the tasting side. It makes a Provençal taste, and it also helps with your peripheral circulation in your body. Then we make the main one is the green tea, which is made with green tea, chili, carob, lavender, seaweed, and pepper dew. By the way, when the vinegar is finished after 5 years, then we macerated it with 5 years with the green tea. So the vinegar is an average age of 10 to 12 years old.
Yeah, and you compare your method to the balsamico method.
Not quite, you know. Balsamic is made, you know, 99.9% of all balsamic vinegar is not balsamic vinegar.
I know that, yes.
Carries its name. The real balsamic, which is extremely expensive, is made with grape juice. And then the vinegar bacteria ferments the grape juice into vinegar acid. We make first good wine. We believe in fermentations. Every fermentation is like a compost. It changes the product into something completely different. So first the grape grows, and it has lots of acid. Then the sun through the leaves changes the acid into sugar. And that balance, that is the best, that's the optimum time to harvest when you get it at the right time. If the sugars are too high, then your acid is too low. So you want to get it at the right balance. Then we make wine from it. And we keep it for 2 years in the barrels. Then we start with the vinegar mother, and then it takes another 3 years to make vinegar.
Where did you get this vinegar mother?
Oh, it's from our farm, from the 1988 involuntary vinegar making, which took about 5 years before it was made.
I see. Okay, so what do you do next then? you're giving us the next step.
In Oh, yes. The next step is, well, the next vinegar we made was the Feinboss, which my daughter made, and that's made from herbs exclusively grown to be found in the Western Cape. The world consists of six floral kingdoms, and the Cape Kingdom is by far the smallest, but has six times as many varieties as the next kingdom.
Wow.
And we have extremely unusual herbs. There are Bushman herbs like Buchu, and we have wild rose geranium, wild rosemary, wild olive, and honeybush in it.
I wondered what that was. It was the first one I tried, and I think I tried it because I didn't know what Feinbush was.
Feinbush. You know protea flowers? Proteas?
Yes.
That's a Feinbush.
Okay.
And so is the rooibos tea, is also fine bush. It means a fine bush, fine boss, Afrikaans.
I see, okay.
Fine bush.
Now, how do people get these vinegars?
Well, this is of course, still a bit of a problem. We are at the moment shipping it from Sedona around the country.
Which is where you are living.
That's where I'm living. And it... you can get it in a few shops already in California and in New York.
But will you be able eventually to get it off of your website?
Yes, my daughter is busy creating a website which should be running within the next 2 weeks, and then people can order directly from that website.
And what will be the URL for that, Kurt?
You know, I must quickly check with my daughter what the website's name going to be.
I think...
www.rosendahlvinegar.co.za. No, CA, because it's the old set Africa, which is the set for zebra.
Oh, okay, so it's ZA.
Well, I mean, I don't know what to, is there anything else we should know about this? Because I just think it's a wonderful product. And I am perfectly happy to drink it right out of the little sample bottles.
Well, that's what I do. I drink it every morning, a little shot, because it helps to balance my pH. So it's very good for health purposes to drink it.
Which one do you use?
I use the green tea mainly.
Okay.
But I change sometimes. Also, what I notice, if you do exercises, if you do intend to do something which you haven't done the next day extreme, and if you drink that vinegar with water while you do the exercises, you should have no lactic acid build up the next day. That means you should have no stiffness. You should be able to walk like if you didn't have exercise.
Well, this is a true revelation, I think, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us, Kurt, and thanks also to Natalie.
It's a great pleasure, ma'am.
Yes, and here's to your continued success and expansion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Thank you very much for taking us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now a break one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, about to get a bit nutty.
Just a little bit nutty, but here's a little piece of trivia for you. What percentage of the world's almonds do you think are grown in the state of California? When you hear the percentage and the quantity, you won't believe it.
I didn't know. Now, Peter, you knew that the Blue Diamond almonds was a cooperative. I just knew it as a continuous, iconic as a product label, and has been for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, it was the brand.
Comes back before that, because they're celebrating their centennial, which is older than I am.
It's the brand name that defines almonds in the United States, and I guess it's fair to say, I mean, I can comment on this somewhat, since my heritage is a little different. Things have been successful in Europe generally if they've been running 500 or 1,000 years, but in the United States it's absolutely dramatically important that something's been running for 100 years, so Blue Diamond must be doing something right, Susan.
Now, we're talking to Susan Browner, actually, so better we have not yet introduced her, and you are a spokesperson for the organization.
Yes, I'm the Director of Public Affairs here at Blue Diamond Almond Growers in Sacramento, California. Been working with the almond growers for over 33 years.
Oh, wow.
So
a newbie there.
No, and it's interesting to note, Peter, that actually 82% of the world supply of almonds is produced by California almond growers, and you mentioned that Blue Diamond is a cooperative. That means they're owned by the growers themselves.
But that's incredible, 82% of the world's almond supply.
Yes,
that's
and
amazing.
It's due to the Mediterranean-like climate. Here in California, it takes bees to pollinate the trees, and we have to have temperatures during the month of February in the 58-degree area, no winds, very mild climate, so that we can pollinate, the bees can pollinate the nuts. Without the bees, there are no nuts.
Right. I mean, this was one of the scares of this colony collapse disorder, when because the almonds, were, you bring in a lot of bees, don't you?
We are big users of bees. They primarily come from the Midwestern areas, and the beekeepers transfer them around
right.
from crop to crop. But we've been very successful in spite of this the bee situation. We are producing, starting a little after Labor Day, the heart of the almond country starts delivering the almonds, and we are expecting 1.65 billion pounds of almonds.
Holy
That's
Moses.
Bees and boy.
Now, let's do a little history here, because 100 years ago, California was a whole lot different, and Blue Diamond didn't exist. So where did the almonds and the almond growers come from?
Well, almonds have been known in most cultures around the world since the beginning of time. They are actually the original food. Almonds were unearthed in an ancient dig in eastern Turkey, and there's evidence, this was also cited in the National Geographic magazine, almonds were the original food, not grains. So they have been around for a long time, and the Spanish missionaries actually started planting them as they went up and down.
Okay, so that's how they came to be in California.
The coast, right. They brought them from the Spanish missionaries, and they planted the trees essentially along the coastline, the northern coastline of California. And in the 1960s to the 1900s, the growers started growing them and becoming familiar with them, and it became obvious to them that they had a crop that was very interesting and could grow in California, so they started wanting to organize an organization that would formally establish the almond industry in California, and that was the California Almond Growers Exchange, which was the actual name of the company. And shortly after they established it, 230 industrious almond growers on May 1910 got together and put together the co-op, and shortly after that decided they needed a way to differentiate themselves from the predominant Italian and Spanish almond crops. For the most part, Americans were eating Spanish and Italian almonds in the early 1900s.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch of almond groves in Italy with those gorgeous flowering trees and that wonderful scent.
There are, but Blue Diamond started working early on, unlike any other ag product in this country, to develop and work with, essentially with Italy and Spain and the Europeans to see how they consumed almonds, how they grew them, took trips over there in the 1920s, which was not by a jet plane, it was by a slow boat.
Oh, yes.
And learned all we could about how the almonds were grown and produced and marketed. For the most part, they were coming into New York, and most of the buyers were European buyers, and they would come out to California. They had heard that we were starting to grow them out here, and they would go by horse and buggy from ranch to ranch and offer various prices, and the growers didn't like that because they never knew who was getting what for their almonds. So that's why they organized the co-op, so that they could have a formal way to gather statistics about the production. At that time, they were growing less than 5 million pounds of almonds.
Now, compared to today, now, so 5 million pounds in the 1920s, now how many pounds today?
Well, in 1910, when we were established, it was less than 5 million pounds, and then today, it's 1.65 billion pounds, as I mentioned, and the almonds will be harvested starting next month, and then they'll really be in full swing after Labor Day as far as harvesting them, and they will be delivering them around the northern parts of the state to our receiving stations, and then we'll start to process them and get them out to the buyers.
Do all these nuts go into the packages with your logo?
No, they don't.
Because I buy bulk almost all the time now.
Yes, but the bulk of almonds are sold as an ingredient in other products. It's the number one ingredient product in the world in the nut industry. Almonds are the largest used nut as an ingredient in foods.
That's,
over 20% of... I'm sorry?
Why is that? I mean, part of the recent surge is because of this peanut allergy, right?
Well, it's because we've worked very hard. Actually, we started in the 1920s to develop nutritional information about almonds, and about 5 years ago, the tree nut industry organized, got a qualified health claim from FDA, and the almond industry itself has spent over $10 million to develop and work with renowned universities and researchers around the world to know more about the nutrition of almonds. They are the highest source of vitamin E. They're very nutritious, and we have validated all of this. They help to lower cholesterol when they're used in a low saturated fat diet. So an ounce and a half a day is the official recommendation.
How many is that? Because I put Peter
on... It's about 24 almonds that are a handful.
I'm way off. I told Peter he had four a day.
No. It's a handful, a good handful, which is about 24 almonds a day.
Oh, dear. We had to make up for all that wasted time.
So
Terry, guidelines that are coming out at the end of this year also solidify that information about the fact that you should be consuming nuts every day.
So it's not just the little cans of almonds with the blue diamond on them. There's a whole distribution of raw almonds that Blue Diamond also does?
Yes, the bulk of our business, 30%, America is by far the largest single market for almonds in the world, but we are also the largest food export in California and among the top 10 food exports in the country. We export to 95 countries around the world, and over 70% of our business is done in the international marketplace, with China, Asia, India being the big growth markets, but the European, both Western and Eastern Europe, consume the bulk of the exported almonds at this point in time, with Spain leading by far.
Isn't that funny? Since
the number one importer of California almonds. So you can see it's a tremendous success story, moving from an unorganized, no industry, almond industry whatsoever in California in the early 1900s to today, providing 82% of the world's supply.
Well, it is. That's why I wanted to talk to you, and you certainly have proved to be a very, very effective spokesperson for this organization. Tell us about the historical website.
Well, I actually am in charge of the website and the history of the company. I do the publications, and then I also do the government relations work for trade policy, but we have had just a giant collection of thousands of old historical photos, pamphlets, booklets. We wrote a book about the first 90 years of our history, and we're adding on the last 10 years this fall. But the book is online on almondhistory.com. It's the largest collection of anything about the history of almonds in the world. And we thought for our centennial that it would be a nice gift to the industry and to those who are interested, our consumers around the world, that we share the history of the industry with them, and that's what almondhistory.com is all about.
Well, this is an absolutely wonderful thing to find out. Who would imagine that California, I mean, California we know is a fine agricultural state, but would dominate the world in such a fashion? Blue Diamond's obviously done a great job, and the almond farmers do a great job. And we're going to have to do.
Now we keep our fingers crossed for the bees. I don't worry about the bees.
And we're going to have to up our consumption.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm really way off. I don't know why I thought of four a day.
Well, we have increased consumption of our branded products, which are the most renowned. We developed the first flavored snack almond in the early 1950s. Smokehouse almonds is
I've had those.
Flagship almond.
Yeah.
But we have also developed the bold flavors of wasabi and soy and jalapeno smokehouse.
Salt
and vinegar, lime and chile, which we, depending on the market, the country, are available in other countries as well. But the branded products, we have gone into the natural food business. We have a new refrigerated almond breeze non-dairy beverage.
Wow.
For the lactose intolerant. We also sell it in an aseptic package that you can keep on your shelf for a year and then refrigerate it and drink it. It's the number one almond non-dairy beverage in America right now.
Yes, that I did know.
Then we came out with a new almond butter line, both homestyle and the regular homestyle and ready spread, they call it, for crunchy, honey, and creamy, and that is going very well. We've positioned it as a breakfast spread, and it's really going very well. So almonds lend themselves naturally to the natural food business because they are a whole food, and the nutritional profile of them just automatically fits with the taste and the ability to adapt to just about any product, any food. You can mix them in various ways with any food that you can imagine anywhere in the world. So I think the ingenuity of the early almond growers and needing to work with the world on, you know, how to process and market the almonds so that they would consume them as well is quite ingenious for a group of California.
Yeah, I feel very proud for some reason.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not my company. I don't have any stock.
We're gonna wave our stars and stripes, and we're gonna
and
put
my
it,
blue diamond.
We're gonna put a big blue diamond
that's
in the middle of it.
That's what I like, is a blue diamond.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today.
Oh, and, you're wonderful, Susan.
Keep us posted if anything really new and exciting happens.
Thank you. A can a week is all we have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, listeners. You can't say you didn't learn a lot today.
Yeah, don't you love learning all these new things? I do.
82%
yeah.
of the world's almonds coming from the state of California, and it started out...
It started out
100 years ago with just a little bit of tree planting by some immigrants who didn't have anything better to do with their time, and look where we are today with Blue Diamond. So it's a great American story.
It is.
It's a great story for the Italians who came and settled in California and planted almonds to grow, and I'm sure you are fascinated by it, and you'll want to eat more almonds because you should. Oh, and I forgot to say, of course, it's time to wrap up the show for another week, so we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.